What if private forest owners could make money off their trees, not by selling off all the timber, but managing their land for conservation? That'd be a good thing, right? The Nature Conservancy thinks it's found a way. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. This is the Allegheny Front. Today we report from the forest and from a community water plant on how something called working woodlands is benefiting both. And are we living in a promised land? That's the name of a new film on the shale gas boom. We talk to moviegoers about their take on it and discuss how true it is with a shale reporter. That and more is coming your way on the Allegheny Front. Please stay tuned. You've heard the term value added, getting unexpected benefits from a product while only putting a little extra effort into it. A new initiative does something like that. Call it value-added forests. The Pennsylvania arm of the Nature Conservancy is working with the owners of the state's private forest lands. Their lands make up more than 70% of Penn's woods. The Conservancy sees in their properties a way to make the state's water and air cleaner and make money for the owners. The Allegheny Front's Ann Murray looked into the Conservancy's new initiative.
A Pennsylvania forest has a new surprising ally. You might even call it a sponsor.
Meet the Chevrolet Equinox and meet a world of new experiences, new places.
Chevy Equinox is not just a smallish SUV the auto giants marketing to the young and hip. It's also paying to keep a forest a forest. Bethlehem, Pennsylvania Water Authority gets paid by Chevrolet for each ton of CO2 that the trees in its 22,000-acre forest pull out of the air and store in their trunks and roots. That's according to Steve Repish, the authority's director.
We're anticipating, to be on the safe side, anywhere between $75,000 and $100,000 annually. If we get more than that, great.
Bethlehem is the first partner in the Nature Conservancy's Working Woodlands program, a model project that the Conservancy has put together with BlueSource, a carbon credit broker in California. Working woodlands is one example of what you might call value-added forestry. That is, a way to keep forests healthy while also making money off them.
For landowners, they kind of get a 1-2 punch.
Roger Williams is the president of BlueSource, the carbon brokerage.
Several years ago, we began conversations with the Nature Conservancy. The intent was to combine FSC forest certification with the creation of carbon credit for landowners that wanted to participate in that market.
FSC is the Forest Stewardship Council. Timber with an FSC certification can be sold for more than regular wood, kind of like organic for trees. Carbon markets, like companies and others, pay forest owners to store CO2 to compensate for their own greenhouse gas emissions. With that in mind, the city of Lockhaven in north central Pennsylvania has just signed on with the Conservancy. Their next step is to take a really close look at their 5,000-acre property. That look begins with an inventory of trees. Forester Mark Banker pounds rebar into the ground to mark one of 1,000 or so small plots that'll be documented. The Nature Conservancy's Mike Eckley calls out the trees he wants to be measured.
Let's start with that white pine right ahead of you.
Banker loops a tape measure around the trunk of the tree.
17. All right, white pine, acceptable growing stock, saw timber.
Eckley records the diameter of the tree and other notes about the tree's health and timber value into a handheld device. An independent auditor will come in later to verify the numbers, and we'll do it again every 5 or 10 years on permanent plots.
Merchantable height of 3 logs, no defect.
The information will help the team decide things like what trees to cut and when. Computer models will predict how much carbon the forest can store. This is key for the carbon markets this forest is tied to. You just can't rent out your woodlot to qualify for these programs. You have to prove that you're increasing the amount of carbon absorbed by actively managing these woods. And you only get paid for the increased amount of carbon your trees store. Josh Parrish runs the Working Woodlands program for the Nature Conservancy.
I tell them that, there is money in them, their trees. They can be rewarded by sustainably managing their property for quality and for quantity. The higher quality trees you have, the faster typically they grow. Growing bigger and older trees will sequester more carbon.
Like Bethlehem, Lock Haven is happy about the chance to make money in the carbon market and sell the higher priced FSC certified timber. But in both cases, their real priority is protecting their watersheds. Healthy forests filter and cool streams that pass through them. That's why the Lock Haven Authority has been buying woodlands in their watershed since 1850. There are, of course, other benefits to keeping woods around. Walk-on recreation will be allowed under Lock Haven's new agreement, along with hunting and timbering, possibly even deep shale drilling. Josh Parrish of the Nature Conservancy says, after all, this is the Working Woodlands program.
Conservation has been moving from kind of set-asides to sustainable management. And that's where also our conservation easements have been moving from being thou shall nots to working with landowners and to manage the lands for sustainable harvests, for carbon, for climate.
The Conservancy hopes to expand Working Woodlands to other Appalachian states and is currently in China in Sichuan province. There's a temporal forest there that looks a lot like the Appalachian woods. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Ann Murray.
Do you know about the Dairy Cliff? It's not a new energy bar. The Allegheny Front's Hal B. Klein finds this was a name for another precipice averted when the overall fiscal cliff deal passed in the final hours of the 112th Congress. A last-minute extension of the 2008 Farm Bill avoided the dairy cliff. Klein found out what the nine-month extension means for farming in Pennsylvania.
The Farm Bill is a massive piece of legislation that sets agricultural and food assistance policy. Although it's normally renegotiated every 5 years, Congress failed to reach a deal before the bill expired on September 30th. Pennsylvania Deputy Agriculture Secretary Jay Howe says that, despite some flaws in the legislation, passing the extension, even at the last minute, was necessary.
The biggest advantage was there would have been a lot of uncertainty if they had done nothing, okay? This way, at least we know there will be a window of time where the programs will continue, and rather than having a void, at least we know what we're dealing with under existing law.
The extension means food stamp benefits won't be cut, direct subsidies to large commodity crop farmers remain, and a so-called dairy cliff, which could have forced milk prices to double, was averted. But smaller programs for new farmers, minority farmers, organic farming research, specialty crops, and sustainable energy were all left out. Brian Snyder, president of the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, calls this troubling.
It's a little alarming, in fact, to find essentially all of the programs that we had developed over the last 20 to 30 years completely gone in this extension. In the middle of the night, legislators were asked, what's really most important here? And they chose to maintain the subsidies, which almost everybody in Congress wanted to get rid of otherwise, and got rid of all of the programs designed to help farmers move into the future with a more viable business plan.
A new Congress means the entire bill must be rewritten. Secretary Howe says that the two chambers were close enough that this is not a big leap to think that they'll reach consensus. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Hal B. Klein.
For the past several years, we've been bringing you stories about Pennsylvania's gas rush. You've heard about new jobs, worrisome spills, and methane in the water. You've heard about tensions among neighbors and communities split over the uneven benefits of drilling. Today, we're going to tell you a story about a woman who tries to heal those divisions over a good plate of food. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports from the Summer House Grill in Montrose, Susquehanna County.
These are all table four.
Welcome. We're here at the Summer House Grill. This was a community dream.
Dragging a pancake and a kale.
Carl, how are you?
I'm doing really
it's
good.
It's sausage and beer night at the Summer House Grill. A busy restaurant that's easy to miss driving along Route 29, the main road through Montrose, a town where everyone's life has changed, one way or another, by gas drilling.
I used to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning because I heard coyotes howling. And now every once in a while I wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning because I hear a backup beeper.
Carl Hagstrom is a farmer and a big fan of the Summer House Grill. a true farm-to-table restaurant that tries to use as many local ingredients as possible. It also serves as a kind of demilitarized zone, or a spot of truce in the gas drilling wars. The woman behind all of this is Kim Glomboski. She grew up with her artist parents on a small farm outside of town. She's neither a farmer or the cook. Glomboski is actually a historian, and she's steeped in knowledge about the area's rich heritage.
All of the different resource extractions that have happened here, from tanning, from timbering, agriculture, coal mining, and this is just like, you know, chapter 31, here we go again.
Some customers refer to her as the UN peacekeeper of the gas fields.
We measure ourselves by where do we stand on this particular issue, and we divide ourselves by that. And if we can find one way to connect over a really good chicken or just an astonishing plate of trout that was grown with love and with care, I'm not trying to be Pollyanna, but I think that it's important to find just little crevices where we can stick our fingers in and say, hey, you know, we're common in this way.
When it comes to gas drilling in northeastern Pennsylvania, there are a lot of divisions.
Sorry to interrupt.
Don't interrupt.
A guy with dreadlocks is pouring beer. I find out his name is John Puzo. He grew up not far from here on his family's fifth generation dairy farm.
I'm just a beer lover. A lover and drinker. A romancer.
Puzo says he's never milked a cow in his life. Instead, he studied music, went to art school, and became a building designer. He says business is booming.
Wicked good. I've already had 90 jobs this year.
Hit it.
Yeah. Could I say it without causing a controversy? This little thing called gas boom. We don't need to get into that heavily, but, you know, there's a lot of work in that right now. And I'm booming because of it. I'm making a good living, so I'd be a hypocrite if I went off on it. I'm not going to do that.
Puzo bought the beer for this event from Endless Brewery, a new microbrewer just down the road operated by John Winans and his wife, Morgan Kelly. They both grew up here too, but Winans says they haven't seen any benefits from gas drilling. As a matter of fact, Kelly says they're worried something bad might happen to their water.
Our water is the number one component in what we're brewing. It is very scary. We haven't had any bad experiences thus far. We get our water tested regularly.
Inside this restaurant, Montrose seems like one lively and happy town. But Puzo, the designer, says the conflicts can run as deep as the gas drills.
I guarantee you there's tension all through this room. Like, the table to the left is one of the loudest advocates, if you will. The table to the right is one of the loudest anti-advocates.
What he means is one group wants more drilling and the other group wants to stop it.
This is kind of interesting. We're living in harmony under this food and fun.
It's a small town. You gotta, you know.
Yeah.
Puzo is hanging out with his friend, Pete Comley. Comley is a chicken farmer. He raises all the chickens roasted at the Summerhouse Grill.
How do we always get on the gas?
I don't know. Because it's big. I mean, it's big, and I think it's going to be here a while. The Summerhouse Grill, you come here for lunch, it's filled with gas guys. I don't know if you've talked to Kim, but I think she probably would say, yeah, they're feeding us. What's next? Want to talk about beer and food, or we got off on the gas track?
But it doesn't matter what they talk about. As Pete says, it always comes back to gas drilling.
Pete and I are musicians also.
Yeah. And really, we could make our living with that.
Yeah.
We choose
we
not to.
We have a great kind of folky bluegrass band called the Belly Floppers. Yeah, sold out shows. We're very popular.
We used to have a guitar player, and he moved away because of the gas.
He was very, very anti-gas. Very.
Did that break up the band? Was that your Yoko?
It did. Actually did. It broke up the band. Yeah. See, there you go.
He loaded his little 10 by 14 house that John designed up on a trailer and hauled it the hell out of here. So.
Yeah. Isn't this fun?
Summerhouse Grill owner Kim Glomboski says when it comes to gas drilling, people on both sides of the issue are afraid. One side is afraid to lose out on a great economic opportunity. The other side fears losing their land and water.
Got the strudel.
Back at the beer keg, customer Kim Harwood has high praise for Glomboski.
What she's doing in this community is remarkable, absolutely remarkable.
Glomboski says she's just trying to do a little of what's needed to keep the community together.
But eventually, it gets
divided enough that a conversation has to happen. And it's sometimes with violence, and it's other times with just, we've just got to figure out a way to deal with this. I'm not willing for the violence part to happen over this, so I run a little restaurant that serves food grown by local farmers in a hope that people can just not think that they're crazy just because they think differently than somebody else. I don't know what else to do.
In Susquehanna County, I'm Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Want to eat now?
Watch video of the Summer House Grill. Go online to stateimpact.npr.org/Pennsylvania. If you've seen the new movie Promised Land, you got Hollywood's take on the divergent views about shale and a glimpse into a community not unlike the one Susan Phillips just took us to. Phillips will join me in a moment to discuss her reporting on something called the truthiness of that film. In Promised Land, Matt Damon works for a big drilling company trying to lease land from residents of a small town. While there, he falls for a local school teacher. John Krasinski plays a guy who's come to town to warn about potential harms of fracking. Let's hear what some moviegoers thought about Promised Land when they were interviewed by the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier.
Can I ask, why did you decide to come to the movie?
The ads are pretty good. There's a lot of press saying it's a good movie. I like Matt Damon.
Well, first of all, you know, I like Matt Damon.
Matt Damon was in it.
And what's his name, Krasinski?
Because I thought it might enlighten me a little more about the issues of fracking.
I liked it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What did you like about it?
The trueness of the story, the facts. It's going on, what's going on in Pennsylvania.
I'm not sure. I know that a big gas company would do whatever they could to get what they wanted, but I'm not sure that they're clever enough or sneaky enough to pull off an act like that. So maybe the story's a little bit stretched, but it was a good story.
It was an interesting movie. And what it does, it causes people to think about, is this the right thing or is it the bad thing?
How much about the issue do you know about?
Not really a whole lot. I've heard that it endangers our water supplies, fracking, but, you know, I'm really not sure.
I've read a little bit about it. I've been to places where they've developed gas, and I've seen the kind of changes that happen in a small town. I think it was probably not as realistic as it could have been.
I mean, I've not sat down and studied it, and I don't think ever will. It's something that's going to happen. We can't stop it. It's going to happen because it's there. People know it's there, and there's big money to be made. And let's face it, big money controls everything.
Do you think you'll go out and try to research the issue more?
Yeah, absolutely.
How sort of accurate does it seem or realistic?
I have no idea. I have no idea. And I have no idea how to go about finding the truth of the information because everything's so skewed everywhere you go anymore.
That was Steve Shriver, Bud Billiard, Donna Petrelli, Joan Raymond, and Joe Zalesniak. The interviews were conducted at movie theaters in Washington and Bridgeville, Pennsylvania, both near Pittsburgh. And Susan Phillips joins me now. She's been reporting on shale and other energy stories for a year and a half with NPR's State Impact Pennsylvania project. We heard one of those stories earlier about a restaurant in shale country and the varying views of its patrons on the shale boom. Susan, Happy New Year, and thanks for talking with me.
It's great to be here.
So you looked at how real or truthy was sort of the word you used that Promised Land is. And first of all, though, you heard our moviegoers. They're really struggling to find information. Some are just saying they think this whole topic is too complicated. They don't expect they'll even invest the time to learn about shale drilling. As a shale reporter, what's your reaction to that?
It's not surprising at all. There's a lot of information out there contradicting itself. There's a lot of misinformation, and there's a lot of polarization when it comes to environmental issues surrounding shale gas drilling and hydraulic fracturing, otherwise known as fracking to most people. And I think the movie itself is a Hollywood movie, so nobody should expect to get an instruction on gas drilling from the movie. And there is a particular scene in the movie where John Krasinski's character, who plays an activist, is in a schoolhouse, a schoolroom.
Right, it's like a play school farm that he says right, is like there's his own farm, yes.
Yeah, he's sitting in front of a classroom full of like third graders or fourth graders, I don't know, and his explanation of fracking is shaking chemicals all over this play school farm and lighting it on fire, which, of course, is not anywhere near reality. But I think when it comes to reporting on shale gas, it is a real challenge to be the honest broker. The information that's out there from both sides tends to get exaggerated, and some information tends to get ignored based on what their point of view is.
Mm. I hope it's not too much of a spoiler to let people know that images of dead cows play a role in this film.
That's right.
And your blog post that you wrote recently looks at whether there really is this link between fracking and bovine deaths. Where did you come down on that?
Well, my first story that I did that had anything to do with livestock or animals and the impact of fracking on farming livestock was when I heard about a quarantine that the Department of Agriculture, the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, had quarantined a herd of cows up in northeast Pennsylvania because they had come in contact with frack water, and the frack water had leaked from a holding pond and the cows had walked through it. And nobody really knows whether they drank it or what happened. It just that they found the hoof prints. They quarantined the cows. And when I followed up, you know, months later with the farmer, she told me that almost all of the calves that had been born of that herd of cattle were either stillborn or severely deformed. And she linked that with, you know, the exposure to the frack water. Of course, she's a farmer. She's not a scientist. But basically what she said was she's been doing this, you know, 50 years, and she's never seen that many calves die. And so then it was part of a study that was done by some researchers into the impact of frack fluid exposure to farm animals. And they made the conclusion that the cattle's association with the spilled frack water contributed to the death of the calves. And that's, of course, still very controversial. The state concluded that there was no impact.
Okay. Finally, this issue of numbers in the shale play is one of the things you looked at. Matt Damon's character, Gasland Man, and he's joined by Frances McDormand. They work for this fictitious company called Global. And at times they offer landowners, primarily farmers, $5,000 an acre and 18% royalties for signing on. Are these in keeping with reality?
Well, they were at the height of the gas boom for sure. And I think that when the gas boom began, you know, these are folks that had been leasing to gas companies for generations, right? So what a lot of farmers told me was, oh, yeah, you know, every so often somebody would knock on their door and ask to lease their mineral rights. And they would give them some amount of money, and that would be enough to pay their taxes that year, but not that much, you know. And then, you know, the folks would never show up and they would never drill. But when it came to the Marcellus, which is a deeper formation and which slick water hydraulic fracturing made it possible and made it worth it for the gas companies to drill, they actually did show up. But a lot of these farmers only got, you know, $50 an acre, $100 an acre. And once the land rush began and the landowners themselves started to realize, oh, wait, you know, there's a lot more money beneath my land than I thought, then the landmen started signing leases for $5,000-$6,000 an acre. So there's a big gap between certain people who signed up early and people who signed up a little later.
So you've gotten a lot of nice interaction from visitors to your website about what they thought of the film. That conversation continues at stateimpact.npr.org/Pennsylvania. Thanks for speaking with me, Susan.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was State Impact Pennsylvania reporter Susan Phillips, who gave us her take on the truthiness of the film Promised Land. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan, and you are listening to the Allegheny Front. We've been celebrating winter by airing a number of stories on how we interact with the snow and cold. I've got a tale, too, about this time of year. Here it is. When I was young, I took direction about how to approach winter from the Olympics and a father who was, how do I say this, kind of a devil-may-care guy. My goal in downhill skiing and ice skating and sledding was to go as fast as I possibly could to fearlessly conquer the elements with maximum intensity. While my mom lived with some trepidation and a constant warning to be careful, my dad egged me on. He found some of the biggest hills in Pittsburgh's suburbs for my flights on an old-fashioned wooden sled with sharp steel runners. I remember hitting a snow embankment once so hard at the end of one of those sledding runs that I blacked out briefly. I instinctively knew not to tell Mom about any potential brain injury, but to stand up as quickly as I could like a brave player walking off the field and waving to the relieved adults. Now that I'm middle-aged, my sense of adventure has changed. Although it's partly due to the cost and time involved, I've pretty much forgone the downhill skiing of my youth. Now you're much more likely to find me slowly cross-country skiing at a local golf course on the old equipment I picked up at a garage sale 15 years ago. Sure, I still get inspired by the Olympics when that redhead snowboarder, nicknamed the Flying Tomato, Sean White, soared around the long, concave, snowy half-pipes. I rented a board myself and took a lesson. I couldn't wait to call Dad and tell him about it. Even if I mostly was content to sit on the board sideways and edge slowly down the base of a bunny hill. My primary snow sport now is walking, and believe me, this is a sport in certain situations. I don't own a car, so I occasionally find myself hiking unmaintained bridges and trails in the worst snowfalls and frozen remnants of storms. I like to think that without a car, I'm living in solidarity with the less fortunate and being environmentally sensitive. And I guess that's true enough, but really, this is fun for me. This past week, I walked a trail along the river that was exceptionally icy in parts. It was clear it would take a while for me to get to the office, so I stopped to call my boss. She offered to pick me up. She's a mom, after all. But I chose to walk the rest of the way, despite the fact that my bones are more brittle than they once were. It was a great walk, and I have my dad in the Olympics to thank for it. After all, I never got hurt, despite my predilection for speed and recklessness. Maybe I have a guardian snow angel. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. For more stories and environmental news, go to our website, alleghenyfront.org. We'd love to hear your winter stories. Tweet us at Allegheny Front or post your favorite images on our Facebook page. Janelle Pfeiffer is our production director and social media guru. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments, the Remmel Foundation, administered by PNC Charitable Trusts, the Laurel Foundation, and the A.D. and J.W. Wilson Fund of the Pittsburgh Foundation.